Hi, this is Corey McRae, the senator for the 45th Legislative District, and you're listening to the Condoyt Street Podcast, my go-to source for the latest news and insight on state and local government in Maryland.
Hello, and welcome to the Condoyt Street Podcast. Kevin Canale here with Michael Sanderson. Michael, we are recording on April 1st, April Fool's Day. Is that kind of weird to you? Is it a joke? Are we supposed to make jokes? I don't really know how to handle this.
I mean, it's a weird day, right? I mean, it's a weird day where you step out of bed feeling defensive and I'm going to check all my priors and be worried. I mean, you know, I don't know if your kids are old enough to take this holiday seriously. It's not even a holiday, but like this date on the calendar seriously. My kids definitely are. My kids are all about like the most, you know, simpleton kind of, you know, hey, there's a bear right behind you kind of thing. So anyway, I'm not too big of a fan, but like you have a big stake in April Fool's Day, like more than most. This is your birthday too, believe it or not.
It is my birthday, and that's not a joke. So I'm used to that. And actually, it's funny. I know so many people with April Fool's birthdays. It's like a club at this point. But the first thing everyone always says is, oh, you're joking. And it's like, no, unfortunately, it's not a joke. I think I was like right after midnight. Like my mom was trying to not have an April Fool's Day baby, but here we are. It worked out okay. But yeah, my kids, they definitely are getting into the trickster phase where they like playing jokes. It's fun. But yeah, it's a weird day to have a birthday for sure.
Yeah. I know like back when I was a young pup doing policy work in Annapolis back in the 1840s or whenever exactly that was, but some time ago I was a younger person and I'm generally anti-holiday, not to have that be like a whole separate riff, but I'm generally not a really big fan of, hey, this day we say these things, but you don't say these on other days. And I don't find much value in that. And The joke on April Fool's always felt stupid to me, but I overcompensated by, like, I would tell people in late March, don't even bother with me. I can't be caught. I cannot be trapped in your stupid April Fool's joke. I'm going to wake up on April 1st and I will know all day to think everything through seven times deep. But it, as it turns out, like that was like walking around with a kick me sign. It was like for several years, like people would go out of their way to come up with convoluted ways so I would fall into the track and actually kind of fall for an April Fool's joke. So I don't know. It got better. But for several years, I did this the wrong way for sure.
Right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting tactic. And, I don't know. I mean, I've already seen a bunch of things this morning and now we're into the afternoon, people posting things that are obviously jokes, but a lot of people fall for them. So, I mean,
yeah, for sure.
It's still a thing. It's still a thing for sure. But Michael, we have 1 week remaining in the legislative session. And today, April Fool's jokes aside, we want to get into what's left on the table. So let's try to get through that. I know we've done some previous episodes where we kind of built up to this point, but let's round it up now and figure out exactly where we are with a week left.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, all joking aside, I think it probably makes sense. There's a fair number of things out there that are cooking, but let's focus this episode on some local government issues and things that affect Maco and our member counties and so forth. I mean, in the big picture, obviously, Maryland policymakers we're in the midst of a great tragedy with the Key Bridge and some lost souls who are on the bridge and sorting out what happened and what do we do next and that sort of stuff. There may be a legislative fallout with some quick recovery sort of stuff. We'll get that sorted out in the space of the next week. I'm pretty confident. Legislature's talking about Pimlico and horse racing and so forth, seemingly like several of the last 5, 6, 7 years we've had this be late
point, right, unless right. There's a late Pimlico bill, it seems.
Right. It just doesn't, yeah, doesn't feel like April unless we're talking about horse tracks. So, yeah. But I think, you know, we want to drill down on the budget plan. That's sort of the biggest thing out there, but a few other issues that I think really do have an on the ground effect on our counties and their ability to deliver services and succeed. So let's try and confine things to our local government universe for the most part, even as we have well wishes for some of these other bigger issues.
Right. So a number of issues out there still that could affect local governments, but let's start with the budget package. It is the elephant in the room right now.
Right, for sure. And so, Kevin, you've been, you know, on this detail, spending the whole session in the fiscal committees and back and forth with them about all the issues that are on the table. So, like, maybe start us off with what's the big deal here? Why is this? Why isn't this settled by now? And what's, you know, what's the state of play?
Yes, I mean, as we've discussed on an earlier episode, this year's budget basically came together fairly easily. They have differences, but nothing really major, no major philosophical issues. And we're talking about the operating budget, and we'll get into some of the philosophical issues elsewhere in a moment. But this budget, the operating budget for fiscal 25, came together fairly easily, even with a lot of noise kind of surrounding Annapolis and the legislature in terms of revenue write-downs and shortfalls and structural deficits, all these big terminology issues, right? So, but at the end of the day, I mean, the general fund, it, you know, the operating budget came together fairly easily for fiscal 25.
All right. So I feel like, okay, we called that basically correctly. It's been a couple of weeks since we've done a podcast, but we did an episode after the Senate had taken its first round of actions and the House had yet to make its own decisions. And there was uncertainty in town. Like, are they going to have big discord? And I think our guidance then was this year should be fine. It's the multi-year process that's probably got the most static. And that does seem to be where they're stuck and where they have some differences now. It's not how to fund the general fund for FY25 that starts this July 1, but more like, what do we do with the special problems in transportation and longer terms, right? So that's kind of where we are.
Right. So the House has signaled from very early on that they wanted to tackle transportation revenue now. We know that the state's facing a multi-billion dollar shortfall in the Transportation Trust Fund, and a lot of really important projects and highway user are coming from that trust fund. So the House, at least House leadership, scheduled very early on that they wanted to do that now this year. Of course, highway user revenue is very, very important to local governments. And the committee's heard from folks like Mayor Brandon Scott, County Executive Johnny Olszewski, who's the Medico president this year, other county leaders, about why this is so important and sort of outlining the history with highway user. And Michael, one thing with highway user that I always, and I think we've talked about this before, but as we go on and on, fewer and fewer legislators are here that were here when the big cuts first took place back in the Great Recession. So a lot of people don't remember how things used to be. So I think part of this is keeping folks educated on the history and why this is so important and how much money has been taken off the table for local governments over the years. Because as legislators shuffle through Annapolis, again, fewer and fewer people remember how it used to be, how it's supposed to be. So the House is really, really, really set on trying to dedicate new revenue to transportation this year. The House put in a lot of revenue bills, transportation, general fund stuff, but mainly where we are now, seemingly is mostly about transportation issues. The House also passed combined reporting, some other revenue raisers. But when it comes to transportation, they passed a suite of bills within the BRFA, the Budget and Reconciliation and Financing Act, and sent that over to the Senate. So that's where we are, at least with the House right now, Michael, in terms of what they've done. And I think we kind of forecasted that as well, that there will be significant differences between the House and the Senate in terms of how they plan to tackle these revenue shortfalls this year.
Right. And I mean, over the course of the session, I mean, both of us have walked these halls for enough time and have gotten to know the players involved that you pick up on clues on some of the big picture plans along the way. Even if the leadership in the legislature can't say, well, here's exactly what we're going to do 6 weeks from now. I mean, it's very hard to have that conversation on Groundhog Day, right? Yeah, what are you all doing in 5 weeks when it's time to make your final decisions? And yeah, you can talk with the chair of the committee or a subcommittee leader or a member who's a veteran on the committee, and sometimes they can say, well, my guess is this, but it kind of depends on that, and you know, a lot of moving parts. That sort of thing is really common. I think in this circumstance, we saw some breadcrumbs that the House had this big, visible hearing early in session that focused on transportation shortfalls. We saw multiple bills introduced by delegates to here's something we could do in the general fund. Here's something we could do to target transportation. Here's something we've never thought of. Here's a loophole that we've left open for a long time. That kind of thing. I think on balance, there were enough clues that I'm not shocked. I'm not shocked that this kind of came together where the House says it's time to go. It's time to really tackle this stuff. And that's kind of where we are. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that is the big thing remaining in the budget package. Do we do something now to stave off these deep transportation cuts and maybe to help the blueprint and how that's going to function? Or do we just play out this year and see where we are later? That's the biggest thing on the table right now. And Michael, the conference committee, which is the House and the Senate, they need to work out those differences. They are actually meeting today on April 1st in Annapolis. Again, that is not a joke. We expect to get some details and some more clarity on how exactly this whole thing is going to shake out.
I think that's about it, right? So one thing that was interesting, by the way, on the path to this was when the House Appropriations Committee sort of unveiled, so first they had a big press event in the morning, what appropriations is going to do with the budget is going to reflect this broader vision of living up to our responsibilities and duties and obligations and so forth. So, you know, a number of leaders behind a podium talking about why to have this ambitious plan. But then when the membership was asked to take their votes on the reconciliation bill, there were a number of members who are not on team raise taxes,
right,
who are saying, like, I'm behind what we're doing on transportation because it's the right thing to do. So that is an interesting bend in this conversation, just worth noting as we saw it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that stems from a lot of folks who normally wouldn't be on board with revenue raisers understand how important transportation is. And a lot of those folks have heard from local governments about highway user revenue. A lot of these people care about transit projects in their communities, right? So it's not just roads, it's transit too. And I think a lot of folks were uncomfortable taking that vote, right? Because you want to say, I'm supporting transportation, and I think we need to shore that up. But also, you know, you're asking me to vote for a revenue package, which some people traditionally would not want to vote for. So it was an interesting, I mean, I was in the room, and I think some people were clearly struggling with how to handle it. And, you know, you get a lot of people explaining their votes, and you heard that a lot. Like you said, I'm for this transportation stuff and shoring it up, but I don't know if I can vote for, you know, revenue and tax increases or fee increases or whatever it is. I'm not sure I could do that. So it was, I agree, Michael, really, really interesting to see how that played out.
Right. So I guess as we try and level set for folks who are trying to keep an eye on the bouncing ball, we're recording on Monday. They're going to meet later today. The big stuff that's on the sort of separating the House and Senate philosophically is mostly in the reconciliation bill, right? So they've got some sort of long-term general fund revenue provisions. They've got a number of things that are in transportation that would let them say, you don't need to cut highway user now. You may not need to make any of these transportation cuts. We can have funded projects and still do like the project maintenance and other things, fund the local transit programs, keep highway user at the levels we have been anticipating because there's the new revenues. You have two different visions of what the reconciliation bill could look like, but you need to pass a reconciliation bill because it does have a bunch of stuff that are needed for this year's budget plan. So you can't just like pass all the FY25 stuff and put off the discussion about later because it's now all in the same bill.
Right. Right. So, I mean, interesting circumstance, and it was interesting the way they went about it and what the House did and sent that over to the Senate. But, you know, we've said it before, the Senate kind of dug their heels in very early on. You were mentioning earlier, we saw signals from the House that they wanted to tackle some of this stuff this year. The Senate has been consistent in their message that they don't want to do that, that they don't feel like they need to take a significant step to address either the transportation trust fund shortfall or just the general fund shortfall in the out years, because primarily because of the blueprint. The Senate has said, we don't need to do it. We're not, you know, nothing's on fire at the moment. But I think some of the recent issues, Michael, and recent stuff in the news maybe changed that a little bit.
Right. I mean, that does seem like the obvious question here. I mean, this was a tricky budget situation. The multi-year plan and what to do about transportation and broad revenues was already tricky. But I mean, okay, so obviously we had this terrible situation in Baltimore with the Key Bridge, and we have more important things that our communities need to focus on. There's a human toll and there's a day-to-day effect and so forth. And you know, it's a city that didn't need another gut punch like this. But does the Key Bridge problem, it's transportation, right? Does this throw a wrinkle into the transportation funding plan?
Well, I mean, I think all of this is with a caveat, right? But I think maybe but probably not the way that someone might be thinking it would in terms of what that means and what the reconstruction would mean for the city.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, on the day the bridge fell, by, you know, a few hours later, I was fielding phone calls from reporters who are trying to cover what does this mean. And some were saying, hey, you know, Mako's been out there talking about roads and bridges all year and how there's a transportation funding crisis and we need these, you know, we need these dollars for road safety and for bridge maintenance and stuff like that. So some of them like leapt to the conclusion, wait, is this part of that? Is this like one of the things that highway user would be required for, that Baltimore needs these funds to go rebuild the Key Bridge? And you know, reporters were asking, is that like, you could, it's a logical question. Wait, does this make our transportation dollars crisis work right now?
Right. It's an understandable question. And I think the short answer is no. The bridge is going to be a joint responsibility of the state and maybe the federal government. President Biden already pledged that the feds would rebuild this bridge. But, you know, things can change in Washington pretty quickly. So for now, we do have a pledge from the president that the federal government is going to cover the cost to rebuild this bridge. But it would not fall on the city to do this regardless.
Right. It's, I mean, so the bridge is owned by the state of Maryland through its transportation authority. But I think, right. I mean, I don't know. This isn't our context, but you would also think that the ship operators would have a play here. I mean, have a role here. I'm by no means are we experts on maritime law, and I've read some things in the paper that this might get murky. But you would think the ship liner would have some stake in the liability here. I don't know. That's a put a pin in it for maybe we bring on some legal beagles later to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot of actors here. You have the owner of the ship, the shipping company, the pilots that were on board, the local pilots. I mean, I've read that, you know, the insurance industry could take a multi-billion dollar loss on this overall from a lot of different factions. Mm. So, yeah, that's something that's out there for sure. But, you know, if the port is shut down, there's a broader impact on the economy. And if companies and shut down and the workers can't work, that hits us in the general fund, as well as in our communities and in the supply chain. So this is a bigger issue when you really start to think about the broad effects. I mean, this is all the way from Garrett County to Worcester in terms of that port and the effect that it has on the state of Maryland, on our economy. And like you said, I mean, people just get into work. There are a lot of people right now out of work. The General Assembly is taking action to try and make sure those people can put food on the table until the port can open up. But it's a big issue for the economy in Maryland and the broader economy in the country, particularly on the East Coast, for sure.
Yeah, I think the big picture here is, I guess, okay, so it's not pressure on the transportation budget, but it's pressure on this local and national economy. And if that means an impediment to general revenues or our local, you know, local ability to bring stuff in through the port and so forth, that's consequential. Yeah.
Right. And so every day, I mean, I know the state every day right now that the port is not open, they're losing millions of dollars in tax revenue that would typically show up in the general fund. And again, there are broader complications, particularly when it comes to the workers. A lot of people right now, a lot of uncertainty in terms of how long it's going to take to clear the channel. I know that they're trying to create a temporary channel to get some of the smaller traffic through. But in terms of, you know, opening up the port and getting that channel clear, it's probably going to take some time. So when you start to add up the days and you start to look at the revenue that's lost, it certainly puts more pressure on the state. And not to mention, Michael, you know, that bridge was a big source of toll revenue. And now you don't have any of that toll revenue. So you have to think about that, too, in terms of Transportation Trust Fund. Don't forget, they're losing out on all that toll revenue now. And who knows? I mean, multi-year and probably to rebuild that thing. So now you have to take that toll revenue out of the equation. And that's certainly something that will hit them and they'll feel it in the budget.
Right. So you're a couple layers deeper into the onion than where we started. It's not as simple as our transportation budget just got worse because we need to build a new bridge. It's actually, this is a dent in the economy. It's a dent in traffic patterns. I mean, and a variety of different things that will show up in multiple ways. I don't know. Like, we probably haven't even peeled the onion sufficiently to realize, wait, there's another consequence here. There's going to be what an effect on the unemployment trust fund or who knows what, right? I mean, so maybe stay tuned on that big picture issue. It may have gotten more complicated, but I don't know. I still feel pretty optimistic that they should be able to pass a budget plan on time, have it done by next Monday. So you drop confetti, you don't have to stay in town for an extra week or come back in June to do the budget. I don't see anything like that happening. Do you agree?
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, they'll be meeting this week. They should get this sorted out in time to wrap on Monday the 8th on signing day. Yeah. So I agree with you there, Michael.
Yeah. Okay. So as this is coming together, the budget conference committees, these are fiscal leaders from both the House and the Senate meeting to sort out their differences and then bring back a final plan that everybody has to agree on. You know, along the way in the whole budget plan, we, Mako, and it was you testifying in the Senate and me testifying in the House, but we raised a few other issues. Can you help run through those, just sort of top off where we are? I know a lot of our members were worried about funding for community colleges. That was one of the things that got not just a kind of abrupt cutback, but also sort of a permanent reformulated in the proposed budget, the reconciliation bill. So where's that heading? Let's start there.
Right. So obviously, big high profile issue. As you said, I think all of our local electeds were reaching out saying, you know, you can't cut community colleges. They're anchor institutions. They're big contributors to the blueprint, et cetera, et cetera. What was on the table originally in the BRFA was a $22 million cut for fiscal 25 for our community colleges. They're not going to do that. They restored about 10 of it. So they got 10 back from that. So it ends up being about 12. In terms of a cut for what they were supposed to get for fiscal 25. So they were among the biggest winners in terms of restoring funding in the budget. So that's good. It went in the right direction, not the wrong one. You mentioned too, there's a longer term issue. And I think that was most of what we raised our issue that, hey, you know, don't do this forever. Don't change the way you fund community colleges forever. Usually in the BRFA, which is again, the Budget Reconciliation Financing Act, it's a companion bill to the budget to make the budget work. Usually that's like, you know, a couple of years, we're not going to do that. Maybe for this year, we're not going to do that. But it's kind of strange to see a permanent change in the BRFA. And what's going to happen is they're going to study the CAID formula. That's the formula that distributes money to our community colleges. So they're going to look at how they count students. They're going to look at a number of different components within that formula. I think that's a good thing. I think that's healthy. So I think we can call it a win in terms of getting some of that money back. It's critical. But then also, getting the smart people in the room to sit down around a table and figure out how we do this and how this is sustainable in the long term while making sure that we're not causing our community colleges to raise tuition or that the counties are going to have to contribute more and more because the state can't meet its obligation. The biggest thing I think we're worried about is raising tuition for kids, and nobody wants to do that. And so we sent that message. I think they heard it loud and clear, and they're going to come up with a solution moving forward. That's the way I read it.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good outcome on balance on a tricky issue. And I mean, along the way, the more I learned about the differentials in student counts and how do you treat the occasional like post, you know, like a graduate student who's taking a course that's going to transfer over and, you know, people who are doing not, I don't know, there's a variety of different stripes of people who end up at our 2-year schools for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And like, let's let cooler heads prevail rather than have something that's driven by we need cash today. Let's spend some time this summer sorting out, all right, how should we classify these dually enrolled kids and these seniors who are doing this and somebody who's pursuing a certificate, ABC? Okay, so sort all that stuff. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. I guess along similar lines, then, a couple of other things that we raised that seemed quirky. We had raised in our testimony on the reconciliation bill some concerns with calculations in the disparity grant. And, you know, we had talked about fluky formulas a few weeks ago and got a fair amount of run from our affected counties on what happens when the disparity grant suddenly crashes and burns and you're left without a bunch of cash that you were counting on. And then we had some stuff with our local health department. So both of those were areas we were saying, there's some tricky sort of technical stuff going on. We're going to get some attention on that as well, right?
Right. So common outcome here, budget language, telling an agency to study something in the coming year. We'll get some attention on these areas that are tricky financially. It's good to have legislators on board with that. You know, the disparity grant program, this is a program that is for poor counties who are making an effort in terms of their tax rate, but they just don't have the base to raise the revenue. So the idea is that the state kicks in some cash to make sure that even though they have a big effort, they're just not able to draw that revenue. So the county's trying the best that it can to raise revenue, but they just don't have the base. So the state has a formula for that. And sometimes you have a big hitter that's, you know, with their taxes, that changes things in the whole state. If a couple people, you know, take capital gains or don't or whatnot, that changes sort of the wealth across the state. And what we're saying is you shouldn't penalize a poor county, a disparity grant county, who's depending on that money when they're doing everything they can. It doesn't make a ton of sense to see wild fluctuations in the disparity grant amounts. So I think we will get some attention on that, maybe a way to smooth that out moving forward. But I think for both health funding and disparity grants, good outcomes in terms of getting eyes on that and attention on it through budget language.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I feel like it's rewarding to raise some of these issues on behalf of our member counties. And I mean, I'm trying to remember, we've had a number of senators and delegates step up and say, we hear what you're talking about, what you're saying makes sense, and I want to help. And almost none of them that I can recall are really saying, because this is about my county that I represent, I'm just worried locally. Right? Yes. I'm not hearing that at all. I'm hearing people saying, well, that doesn't sound fair. We need to dig in on that. And it's really rewarding to hear folks where it's not because they're friends of Mako, or it's not because, you know, this is a Charles County problem and I represent Charles County, so I'm here to help. It wasn't that at all. It was, we make the case, this should worry you just generally, and they take it up and say, you're right, let's get this sorted out. It's rewarding to see that. I mean, sometimes folks come to the aid of their district, that's fine. But this is actually on a different level. I love seeing it. So.
It's always good. It's always good when you can argue policy and people understand and listen, even when it's folks, like you said, who are not from necessarily an affected jurisdiction. They understand the policy. They understand that we need to make a change because this just doesn't work and it doesn't make a ton of sense. So it is always rewarding when people do listen to you and they hear what you're saying and they take a look at it and they take the time. And again, I think that the entire legislature mostly understands that this is a problem and that you shouldn't have these wild swings from year to year for the disparity grant funding amounts just because a few taxpayers may change the whole base across the state. So yes, I agree. Always rewarding when you can talk about policy and you're heard and they actually take action to do something about it. They don't have to be from a jurisdiction that's affected, but most of the people down here, they do care about policy. They care about the state and our residents. And ultimately, this is about residents and services. So right. I don't think anybody wants to see cuts, particularly in poor counties, because those services mean a lot more maybe than a wealthy county.
Yep, that's well said. So, okay. So if that's our run through on the big budget plan, that's got to get sorted out in the space of the next week. And there's a few other issues that have meaningful consequences for counties along the way. We've gotten some help. We've gotten some attention on things. I think that's a good outcome. We'll see what happens on the big picture stuff. Folks know this is our bag. Like, we want to talk taxes. We want to talk budgets. We like numbers. We're into all that. Some people are into it. Some people want to know about the rest of the show. Like, we could do two more hours running down 25 different bills and so forth. That's probably more than even our most supportive fans would take. So maybe we'll just hit a couple of high notes on non-budget topics that we've been following that are still kind of unfinished. I want to start with one that you've been following more closely than I have, and I've kind of lost track of this a little bit, but I know there are, I guess, a couple bills about specifying zoning for the newly licensed sellers of cannabis that are coming later this year. We want to have ground rules on where they can go and sort of limits on the local zoning. We've got two different bills, right? So can you catch us up there?
Right. So there are a couple bills that are cross-filed that deal with zoning and cannabis. With the state legalized adult use cannabis, and that, you know, the majority, vast majority of Marylanders said yes. The state actually rolled that out very quickly, and the rollout has been good. I haven't heard any major complaints about how it's been going, and hats off to the Maryland Cannabis Administration for a successful rollout. So now we're to the point where, okay, the state's going to have a certain number of licenses for dispensaries where you actually go and purchase the cannabis. They'll have a certain amount of licenses for growers and processors, et cetera, et cetera. And they want to do that equitably across the state. Part of the whole plan was, we don't want dispensaries or growers or processors, you know, all in one geographic area. We want to make sure that it's across the state. And so they have a limited number of licenses. And what they're concerned with is local zoning, kind of zoning these folks out of existence so that they can't operate within a jurisdiction, or that they're just, you know, all jumbled together in one part of a jurisdiction. So there's this issue now with zoning and where these things can go. And obviously zoning is part and parcel to what we do. It's part and parcel to local government. And so I think, you know, at this point, the House and the Senate bills are different. The Senate added more amendments that we requested, and it's been quite a back and forth, but they are in different postures. I think at the end of the day, the House also took some amendments, but we're looking for just a little more control. For instance, you know, we're saying, hey, how about we don't allow a dispensary to go within 100 feet of an area that's purely residential? So, right, you know, your kid's out in the front yard, maybe we shouldn't have a dispensary within 100 feet. The House did not do that, but the Senate did. And they also did a few other things. So I think we need some clarification, but we want to make sure that counties retain flexibility and that we have the ability to react to our constituents and what they're saying. Because, Michael, a lot of this, in my opinion, is just people are not sure what's going on. This is very new. This rolled out quickly. And I think people don't understand that there are a limited number of licenses. So you won't have, you know, folks popping up all over the place, like some of these smoke shops that you see all over and liquor stores, whatever. That's not going to happen because there are only so many licenses that can be issued. And that is also within a county, there are so many licenses. So I think a lot of it is just residents who are unsure, who don't understand, and their local elected officials are reacting to them as they should. So we're trying to balance all of that down here. I'm confident we'll have a good resolution, but they're probably going to have to end up in conference, the House and the Senate, to resolve the issues with that bill, the differences that they have at this point.
Right. So, I mean, you know, my recollection after having been engaged on the big implementation bill for cannabis last session in 2023 was, I remember being at the table and saying, you've got this phrase, reasonable zoning, and that's all you're saying in the bill. Like, everybody I've talked to has the same conclusion, that that phrase is just going to send everybody to court. And so, lo and behold, here we are a year later, and everybody agrees we really need to tidy up that section of law and spell out more details. And when you draw lines and say, up to this line is reasonable and beyond this line is unreasonable, mm-hmm, you've dramatically reduced the number of things that will end up just litigating for months and months and slowing down this rollout. Like, right, if you want everybody to have clarity, give us direction on this is fine, but that's not. And that's the gist of this bill. I think, you know, the more clarity, the better. Where we have flexibility to tend to, you know, sensitive areas like fully residential. I mean, I'm a big believer in that amendment language. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see it happen, but okay. We think they probably can work something out this year, but man, we knew there was a fix-it bill coming for sure.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of confusion after last session in terms of legislative intent. So there's been a lot of round and round, and here we are trying to work this out. We're in the last week. I do think they're going to have to come together and resolve their differences, but at the end of the day, we do need some clarity. You're right. We said last year, this is only going to end up in court. Nobody knows what reasonable means. I don't know what it means. You don't know what it means. No one does. That would have to go to court, and a judge would interpret what that meant. So that would slow down the whole thing. I think this is important, but we just need to get it right. And again, retain flexibility so that we can respond to our constituents and make sure that we can preserve the health, safety, and just the community feel within our communities, and that people know what's going on. And I do want to say again, MCA, the Maryland Cannabis Administration, they've been really good partners. They have, to my knowledge, they've never turned down an invitation to go speak in a county. They've come to all of our events. We've had symposiums, yeah, conferences. They're always there. So that's really good that you have a partner like that who's willing to stay engaged and to kind of work through things together. But then the legislature gets their hands on it, and we'll see what they do. So I think at the end of the day, we'll see, but they're going to resolve it, and I expect there'll be a bill.
Right. So for our members who are following that issue, we're optimistic that a bill's going to happen, but there's stuff that's got to get sorted out. But the easiest path, in my view, is probably the House could look at the Senate bill and say, all right, you added some stuff we didn't do, but this stuff is fine, we concur. So that seems like the easiest path to me. But far be it for me to get out over my skis on an issue I don't know what's on about.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, this, I think at the end of the day, more information getting out to residents and county decision makers, that's what's going to happen here. I think some clarity is really good. That's what we need. But like you said, we'll see what's going to happen. Some other stuff, Michael, we know that there are a few bills on school budget transparency, and they look to be on their way toward passage, right? So just kind of shifting gears here from cannabis to schools. We have an initiative about school budget transparency. And again, there are a few bills and they look like they're on the way toward a good outcome.
Right. It's a little difficult if you don't speak sort of Annapolis legislative process as a native language, which, you know, some of our loyal, faithful listeners are folks who understand what special orders are and what the difference is between a legislative day and a calendar day. And all that stuff is in the bonus content, right? That'll be on the separate page. But I would say that where we are with these two bills is that we put in cross-filed bills. We had a Senate sponsor and House sponsor who were introducing the bills basically on our behalf and partnering with us on it. And as it turns out, the House passed a version of their bill and they made some changes. The Senate passed a version of their bill and they made some changes, and the two were not exactly the same. So there were some differences in one particular section of the bill that were substantive and meaningful. And frequently, if you let the process follow its normal course, what happens is the Senate says, we don't like the House version. And then the House says, we don't like the Senate version. And these sort of day-by-day messages go back and forth between the two chambers. The Senate appoints a few conferees to work out the differences. The House, like later that day or the next day, they appoint their own conferees. And it's like a miniature version of what's happening with the budget right now, and happens every year with the budget. But here's this one bill. We disagree on these couple of things. You half dozen legislators go work it out and bring us back a final product that goes straight to the floor of both chambers, and it's an up or down vote. So that's how you get an identical version of the bill passed when there are differences like that. As it turns out, what's happening with our transparency bill is sort of, let's avoid all that process. So we worked with the two sponsors, WeMaco and a number of the counties who are big stakeholders in this process. And I think some of the other stakeholders who had raised concerns, either technical or substantive concerns with the bills that turned into these amendments, kind of a broader collaboration saying, okay, what if this part of the bill just comes out and then we don't have to debate about version A and version B and alternatives and language, because we'll just sidestep that issue. And sometimes that's the easiest way to sort this stuff out. So rather than having a bunch of process ahead of us where a conference committee was going to have to spend 2 or 3 days ironing out, drafting up alternatives, weighing amendments and stuff like that, it's like, just forget it. This one piece turned out to be too hard. So let's skip it, leave the rest of the bill that we all agree on fine. And it looks like everybody's happy in the valley now. So the House has passed that amended version onto the Senate bill. The Senate has passed that amended version onto the House bill. All the two sides need to do is say, we agree with what you all did with our bill. That's fine. And everything's going to be copacetic. We'll have two passed bills.
Right. So more information out to residents who understand school spending, county decision makers, and the school budgeting process. It's a huge budget item for every single county. It's about 50% typically of a county's budget. So I think it's good for everyone to understand where that money is going, and especially for constituents, for taxpayers, our residents, who many of them want to know what's going on and they're invested in the county budget process. So I think more information, more transparency is good for everyone. I think that's a good outcome and very much worth the back and forth, Michael.
Yep, I agree. I feel pretty good about where we're going to land there, apparently. So maybe let's take a couple minutes on another thing that's not fully resolved, but it's coming into clearer focus now than last we spoke. The governor had a package of multiple bills about promoting affordable housing and trying to turn levers and dials and ratchets and so forth to create more opportunities for Marylanders to find a place to buy or to rent or to live in the areas where they'd like to live. Let's do a quick reset on that bill. It's not done, but we can kind of see from here to done, I think.
Right. So obviously housing affordability is a huge issue. not just here in Maryland, but across the country. And there are many, many different reasons for that. I think sometimes people want to key in on a couple different things as being the main drivers, but we know this is an issue with multiple different issues affecting it, right? So affordable housing is a big deal. So with the governor's package, the House worked on the bill first. That's a very common thing with a really broad bill where there's a lot of interest from a lot of different people. One chamber will work first and sort of a handshake deal that one side goes, then the other side will work from their product, right? So the House started this bill, they moved it. Now the Senate is going to get the House version of the bill and probably work off that product, just like they do with the budget each year.
Right. So that process is not something to panic about. And we got word early that just because this bill didn't make it from the House to the Senate by that crossover deadline, don't panic. We're going to get it out of the Rules Committee. We have this in mind. We're going to try and use the soft spots on the legislative calendar to get a lot of work done on this bill. And that's what's happened. The House moved their bill with a variety of amendments. And I think the subcommittee in the Environment and Transportation Committee, the housing subcommittee that spent a lot of time on this bill, did a bunch of heavy lifting to bring lots of different stakeholders on board or calm down or smooth down edges and stuff like that. So the House passed a bill with a number of amendments. One thing I'll mention, I don't want to get into chapter and verse. I think it's too thick for this setting, but one that many county people had been watching closely with a lot of concern was APFOs. This is an adequate public facilities ordinance. Generally speaking, this is a local law that says don't build beyond what you can handle. So you don't give out more building permits in an area where the schools are already above capacity. We can't have another 800 units of housing of any sort come into this neighborhood if the high school is already at 118% of what it was designed for. And we have no place to put any new kindergartners. So in general, the APFO has been basically a smart growth tool. Like, don't outgrow your means. If you have to expand your wastewater system or your stormwater structures or your school capacity, do that. And then you've got an area where you can grow and then target growth there. But the APFO as a local tool, there was a piece in this bill. It was arguably narrow, but it was still saying we're going to override the local ordinance of that sort. And some people were concerned, I think with their heart in the right place, saying, listen, I'm for affordable housing, but I don't think it's smart to just waive these ordinances that are meant to avoid overcrowding. We don't want to have the people who are benefiting from an affordable housing program, suddenly all their kids are in trailers and in overcrowded schools, and they're getting a subpar education as a result of that. That's not the right outcome, right? So anyway, that has come out of the bill. I don't think that debate is over, but it's no longer in the bill that they're considering. It's moved out of the House and into the Senate. It's narrower in multiple ways, but that's a big and important one of them.
Yeah, definitely. That was a big one. And, you know, I agree that the House Subcommittee and ENT and the Environment and Transportation Committee did a ton of work. They brought in a lot of stakeholders. They had multiple work sessions. So now the Senate, Michael, has a relatively short window to either finish it up or maybe just pass the House bill. I don't think we have any firm predictions here, but I will say it would be pretty rare, I think, for a giant bill like this with so many different policy changes for one chamber just to take what the other one did and not make any changes. That would be rare. But, you know, we have a week left. So the clock starts ticking a little bit and you think, oh, it's a week. That's plenty of time. And they can make things work. But you also have to think about floor schedules. And there are a lot of bills that are moving that will take time on the floor to debate, the housing bill being one of them, for sure. So, you know, you start looking at the floor and the schedule and you start worrying a little bit at this point, I think, about things getting backed up. And, you know, every sign you die there, you know, the end of session, there are always a number of bills that just they didn't get to. Right. They were still up there. And if they would have had five more minutes, maybe they would have gotten to that bill, but they ran out. So, you know, while there is some downtime, like last week was kind of, you know, after they do the budget and it's kind of a downtime and people are kind of, you know, crossovers done and they're trying to catch up. I think now things get ramped up again into high gear because you start looking at the date and thinking, wow, we have a lot to get through. So we need to get things moving. And certainly the housing bill you know, they need to move that bill as quickly as possible, I think, to get it, you know, in a good posture and in a position to move before Sine died and be done.
Right. So I think you're right on process. A week feels like plenty of time. There are reasons to be a little bit concerned on that. This is a bill that I think there's a pretty broad consensus among leadership that it's worth passing.
Definitely.
So that's one thing you got going for you, is it's not like 40% of the entire legislature would rather see the bill just die. I think almost everybody is on board that a version of this bill ought to pass, and let's just try and refine it as best we can. So you're into timing stuff. I mean, we in local government, we kind of do have another one of those wording issues where, hey, with this, with the wording as it reads in the bill, this sounds like we're going to just end up in court on a bunch of stuff. And I don't know. It's not clear to me that the process has enough bend in it to allow a big full debate on a technical issue like the stuff that we're raising. I mean, I think our stuff is legit. It's just a question of timing and what they want to do. I would guess, though, if the Senate makes amendments and changes the bill, it will be awfully tempting for them to do so and kind of get a handshake from the House. Okay, that sounds fine. That sounds fine. We'll just accept your tweaks to our heavily amended bill and we'll be done. We'll just accept the Senate bill as it comes back. So if this turns into amendments in the Senate, then I think the smart money is that the House reads that stuff over and says, deal, we're done.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, look, there's no doubt that there is enough political will to get this done. Fully expect the bill to pass in some capacity. I think, though, that the longer you wait, the more pressure that puts on, again, floor schedules, and maybe, you know, a couple bills that could have gone and could have passed just get caught behind this one. So I think there is a lot of pressure to move the bill. There is a lot of pressure to get it on the floor, to get that debate done. The House has already passed it. The Senate has not yet had this debate. So you should expect a good chunk of time on the floor. You'll probably see, you know, special orders or, you know, people laying the bill over to have more time to take a look at what the Senate did. So it just becomes now sort of process-wise a little bit difficult to get a big bill like that through. But again, I think all the will in the world will do it. It's just some of the other bills that maybe get stuck behind it, they may be in some jeopardy, maybe not as high profile, but somebody cares about them, that's for sure.
Yep. So I think, I mean, but that's a common refrain down the stretch of every session. You get to a week left and then it's 3 or 4 days left. And then it's, are they both coming in on Saturday? Because I have a bill that needs to make it, you know, through second reader and then third reader on the Senate. And then the House has to hear it and they have to accept the amendments. And then that, you know, so people are starting to say, wait, my bill has a bunch of hurdles to clear to get passed. So that's definitely something you hear walking around Annapolis these last 7 or 8 days. So no surprise that, you know, spring is in the air, the cherry blossoms and panic about legislative process.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll just say that with this housing bill, we knew it was coming. We were engaged in conversations early. I'm really proud of MACO as an organization and our members, our local electeds, and how they've engaged in this process. Obviously, giant bill, lots of implications, but we all want the same thing, right? We all want more affordable housing. We want to make sure that affordable housing, workforce housing is available. That's something that everybody can agree on. It's just working out how do you get there and what levers can you pull without upsetting other things that are super important locally. And I know we're going to get there, but we have our fingerprints all over this bill. We've gotten a lot of good amendments, I think, clarifying amendments that maybe people didn't think about. Pulling this lever would affect this thing over here. And we've been engaging with the governor's office and they've been good going back and forth, taking amendments. You know, we have some policy differences on some, but at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. We'll get there. It's just, you know, getting through these last few hurdles and trying to make it work. And then, Michael, you know, like cannabis, you may have a fix-it bill that comes back next year and the year after and the year after and the year after. This issue never goes away. But I think that I'm proud of our organization and how we've handled this and our members and their engagement. Again, you can see their input in the bill. And so that's always a good thing to see.
Yep. All good here. All right. Lots of other stuff out there, but why don't we leave it there for now? We'll continue coverage on the Conduit Street blog as bills are moving and not moving and getting amended and so forth. So keep up with us day by day over there. And we'll see. We'll have new content for listeners sometime very soon, I'm sure.
Yes. And if you're looking for, I think Michael mentioned earlier, we could go hours and hours. I promise that after Sine die, we will go, we'll have our policy team on, our teammates, and we'll run through all the different policy portfolios, what happened which bills passed, which bills didn't, which bills we should expect next year, some of the new issues that have popped up during the session. So you can expect all that after session when we have time to breathe and sit down and go through everything. So you will get that. And we will be back, I'm sure, very soon as well, Michael, to sort of talk about the final days of session and how this all shakes out. But I agree we should leave it there for today. And as always, if you enjoy the podcast, please go ahead and subscribe. That way, all these episodes will be sent directly to the device of your choice. You can also follow along on social media, Facebook, Twitter. And then, of course, this is the most important time to be keeping an eye and reading the Conduit Street blog. Tons of new stuff every single day, in-depth coverage that you won't find anywhere else. So make sure that you're subscribing and reading the Conduit Street blog. But for Michael Sanderson, this is Kevin Canale signing off, and we will talk to you soon.